everyone. Thanks for checking out another podcast. Today I've got Professor Jace Valcor from the University of Houston with me to talk about the current state of U.S. policing as it relates to the treatment of the transgender community. So we're going to start by talking a little bit about the history of policing and the transgender community, what has changed over time and really what hasn't. And then we're going to talk also about amidst this era of reform in policing, it looks like this is a period of transition for policing as an institution in the United States. What types of policies can be implemented to improve conditions for people in the transgender community? We're also going to talk about intersectionality, that the transgender community is extremely diverse and one's race, socioeconomic status, and a variety of other factors influence how you're going to interact with the world. And then Professor Valcor also talks about their journey into academia and what drew them to the research and some of their own experiences in police training environments and observations. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the existing literature. It's going to be a really interesting conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time. If you find this content valuable, please follow me on Twitter at Thomas Owen Baker. And then if you are watching this on YouTube, please hit the subscribe button. It ensures that more people will see this content. And I really appreciate your time. Sit back and enjoy. Thanks. Hey, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time. I did a brief introduction ahead of time, but if you could just maybe give people an idea a little bit more about you. Can you tell us maybe where you start by where you grew up?
Sure. I grew up in the Midwest, North Midwest. I was born in Michigan, moved to Carmel, Indiana when I was six, and that's where I was raised more or less, which is a conservative, wealthy suburb of Indianapolis. Undergraduate degree was at Eastern Illinois University, so not too far away, still in the Midwest. And then finally, for personal reasons, I left the Midwest, wasn't particularly comfortable there. And I did all my graduate work at University of Colorado, Denver. And then directly from Denver to where I am now, Houston, Texas.
Okay. And I saw in your bio said that, because I ask everyone, what got you interested in studying what you study? And you say that this started like in junior high, you were interested in the criminal justice system. Like I wasn't. What was it that caught your attention?
Specifically for me, so in eighth grade, two things happened simultaneously. My eldest brother graduated from law school and I took a career aptitude test that said I should be a judge. And so, of course, like a lot of Americans, I was also, very much into CSI and for me, like X-Files, all those like FBI cop shows, right? So I was like, oh yeah, this is going to be awesome, right? We get students all the time who still don't recognize that it's just entertainment. It's just entertainment. It's not real at all. But yeah, so I just went down that road. I was in a wealthy suburb, so I was able to start taking like criminal law, intro to CJ type courses in high school, and just continued down that path. I thought I wanted to be an FBI agent, went to grad school, still aiming for federal law enforcement, but then got picked up by a professor who wanted me to work with her on some research projects. So I did my thesis with her. She ended up being my dissertation chair as well. And I ended up in the academy instead.
Okay. So it was more of like thinking about being a practitioner and then along the way sort of fell into research and fell in love with it. And
yeah. Basically. Yeah. I had professors along the way in my undergrad who said, hey, you've got a talent for this, you should go to grad school. And then I got to grad school and I got picked up by some more who said, do research with us, get your PhD. And so I went along with it. At the time it made me more comfortable because my conception of federal law enforcement versus my conception of higher education was that as a queer person, I would be better off in the academy. So that also was a definite factor for me deciding to go that route.
How do you still feel that's true? Do you feel as though the academy is a welcoming and accepting, as a welcoming and accepting place as you thought it would be?
That's not a universal truth, of course. No. For me, I have been fortunate. I have had, as far as that goes, I have not had significant issues. I mean, I came to the University of Houston downtown specifically because I had a sense that it wouldn't be an issue, right? Like, I specifically chose this place. During my interview process, I was open. At the time, I was identifying as genderqueer. Now I'm just boring old trans guy. But, you know, I made sure that they were aware of who I was and the type of work that I did so that when I got here, it wouldn't be an issue, right? Like, but no, that's not a universal experience by any means.
Yeah, I've been kind of surprised because I come from, like, I was in the military when I was 18, and then I was in policing, and then coming into the academy, I had these preconceived notions about the academy as being this, like, uber accepting environment where class and race were and status and hierarchy were frowned upon, and they were trying to create this new, but to come to find that I can honestly say that my the military and police department, in my experience, took thing like issues of, like, racial inequality, like, they spent a lot more time trying to address them in a real, maybe the problems are worse in those. I'm sure that they are in many respects, but I've been kind of surprised. So I just thought it was interesting that you would say that was one of the things, because it was one of the things that drew me to the academy as well, as I thought, you know, this is a place where, but it's not monolithic. So everyone's talking about police reform, abolishing the police, defunding the police, fundamentally changing the structure of policing in the United States. And it's been discussed mostly recently along sort of, you know, race in America and sort of solving that, you know, centuries old, healing that centuries old wound. But there are lots of other things going on in policing. And this is a moment where we can, I think, say, what other things do we want to, what other changes do we want to make? I think that's what's happening anyway. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the relationship between the police and the transgender community in the United States? Can you tell us a little bit about that history?
Yeah, sure. So, policing as an issue, a project in the U.S., you know, the issues that we have for it all come from the same place, right? It, as an institution, it was designed to be an element of social control, right? And that obviously was initially and most severely has been used along racial lines. But it's also a tool of social control when it comes to gender and sexuality norms. It's a fraught history. It's a negative history. It's not a positive one by any means. It's shifting, as all things are. But for a long time, you know, police were used. Like in the 20th century U.S., for example, it was very common for cities to have cross-dressing laws, cross-dressing ordinances, and police were tasked with, you know, like in Houston, for example, the HPD's vice squad specifically was tasked with going into the gay neighborhood, and, you know, rounding up transgender women, rounding up butch lesbian women who were wearing too many articles of quote unquote male clothing, right? That was common. Raiding the gay bars. I'm sure most people by now are familiar with that history, at least have heard of it, are familiar with different, you know, protests and uprising against the police raids that were happening all across the country. Stonewall's the most famous one, but there was a couple others, like the Compton Cafeteria in San Francisco and the Black Cat Tavern in Los Angeles that happened before Stonewall, where police would just go into the gay bars, to the LGBTQ bars, and arrest people for things like resisting arrest. Like, they would just basically come up with things, and they would you know, they would come up with like, not vagrancy, what was the, oh, indecency, like very general, broad indecency statutes that they would apply and things like that. Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's not ancient history. That's in the lifetime of a lot, most people who are alive right now.
Yeah, we're not talking about like 100 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. No, we're talking like 60s, 70s, 80s. Houston's cross-dressing ordinance wasn't repealed until 1980. So, you know, it hasn't been that long. And culturally, socially, right, all the stereotypes and conceptions of transgender people as being deviant, as being criminals, did not go away. They were not erased just because that specific law was removed from the books. So I don't know if you want me to go jump into present day.
Well, I think what you touched on, like why the police were this, you sort of like weren't quite sure what to call it. It was a project, but, and I agree, like what it is, I don't know. But I think that when I read about the origins of modern metropolitan police departments in England and the United States, they're something that emerged to create an environment that's conducive to commerce and capital and business. And, you know, this, the Industrial Revolution comes along and we have all these people and we create this mechanism to control people. Mm-hmm. And drive them into what the society views as productive, you know, ways of living, and that extends into racially segregating people, but in terms of sexuality and gender and these issues, that it's the state wanted people to live a certain way, and it was the police who were out enforcing that with violence. So yeah. this is not just asking people to live a certain way, but having men, mostly men, armed with clubs and sticks and beating people and arresting people. So this is a violent history, and it's relatively new. So that's what we have as a history. Can you now, so like you said, move into what is it today in America? How do police manage this today?
Right. So, really not much has changed, unfortunately. I mean, there are attempts for sure. There are agencies around the country, Houston, Atlanta, off the top of my head, that have been in the news specifically because they are trying to address the issue and to train their officers to respectfully interact with the transgender community. You know, but that's not even close to being universal, and is limited in its effect, as we know. Police training is limited in its positive impact. So for the transgender community, right now, when it comes to police interactions, they are still very much being criminalized and treated as deviant, especially trans women of color in particular. A lot of people have probably heard the term driving while black, which relates to, you know, black people being indiscriminately pulled over for pretextual stops and things like that without, you know, cause. Well, in the trans community, there's something known as walking while trans, which refers to the frequent occasion in which trans women, especially trans women of color, are stopped by police while they're walking down the street, questioned, harassed, and sometimes arrested under the assumption that they are sex workers. And, you know, police will, yeah, so that's a universal problem. Like there's only one study or one survey that we can say is like nationally representative of the trans community, and that's the 2015 US Trans Survey from the National Center on Transgender Equality. And it highlights this exact problem. About one third of trans women say that they've experienced this exact thing of being stopped and questioned or harassed or arrested by police. Even higher numbers, 60% of trans people report that they have been mistreated by police just in general, whether it was something like being purposely misgendered or all the way up to, you know, physical and sexual assault. And that's ridiculously high percentage that no one should be okay with. Yeah, so that's core issue. And it's also why you see, I mean, we're luckily, thankfully, people are starting to get a more accurate sense of history, both for the Black community and the trans community at the same time right now, because as we have to frequently remind people, you know, Stonewall was started by trans women of color, Marsha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera, who led that. You know, trans women of color have been at the forefront of a lot of these movements. Black women in specifically, Black scholars have been at the writing about abolition and police reform for, you know, decades and decades and decades, and just no one is listening to them until now, right? So
So you're seeing this as, so there's this history, and you're saying that hasn't really changed, just maybe like different statutes are being used to enforce things. Maybe they're a different environment, but at a fundamental level, you still have basically an armed force trying to control people's human beings for who they are. But I think it's interesting that you talk about the role, because I say like the transgender community, like it's this group of, this monolithic group of people who experience things in the same way. Can you talk a little bit about how, like, intersectionality? So if I'm a trans woman who lives in a wealthy community, and I'm white and I have a job making good money, there's insulation. Can you just talk a little bit about the intersectionality of the experience?
Oh, of course. All of this is intersectional, of course. I mean, like, I am a white trans man, so I am extremely privileged over trans women in general, and definitely trans people of color. So, like, one of the things that is also notable about the trans community is that they have disproportionately high rates of unemployment and housing insecurity, homelessness, because they struggle to hold jobs, to get jobs. You know, we just had a Supreme Court case, Supreme Court ruling about this, emphasizing that LGBTQ people, including trans people, have federal protections and employment, but there's still no law. There's still no federal law. There's still, I don't even know how many states, 30, 20 some odd states that don't have that law on the books protecting LGBTQ people. Texas was one of those. Technically, my university could fire me simply because I'm trans. They won't do that. Obviously, they have their own policies, their own standards, and I wouldn't be here, you know, but technically they could. And I would have no redress except for a federal lawsuit, which obviously the average person cannot afford, does not have the time or resources to go through. That's a major issue. And that's obviously relates to why a lot of trans women don't have jobs, why they do end up on the streets. And I mean, they're just targeted for violence at disproportionate rates, whether it's from a police officer or from someone they meet on the street. Trans women of color are murdered at extraordinarily high rates. And one of the worst things about it is that their murders are often the most like brutal, horrifying things that you can think of. All because some guy freaks out or, you know, has some messed up notion of his masculinity and his sexuality. And because of our social stereotypes of trans people, they're not seen as human. They're not seen as equal. They're not seen as people worthy of respect. So disposing of them in violent ways, you know, that's the consequence of that. So yeah, it's very, 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 people who do know a little bit, probably get it from the media, right? So they have distorted understanding because they see someone like Caitlyn Jenner or Laverne Cox and they're like, oh, you know, they're successful. They're, you know, they haven't had any issues transitioning or, you know, anything like that. But obviously they are not typical.
No.
Right? Because they are wealthy, they are famous, they are all of those things that the average person is not. So assuming that their stories are the norm is definitely definitely a big mistake. I mean, even for trans men, so trans men are advantaged because masculinity is advantaged in our society. So it's much easier for us to transition. We are less likely to be questioned and harassed and stuff once we have transitioned. But it's different for me as a white guy than it is for some of trans guys I know of color. Like for me, transitioning has given me a sense of safety and security and confidence in public spaces that I did not have before.
Because, I can imagine, yeah.
Yes, because now that I'm readily seen and treated as a white man, well, hey, you know, that puts me at the top, right? But if you are switching and now being read and perceived as a black man, all of a sudden you are at risk and you are viewed as a criminal and a threat. And so your transition is not as, you know, does not come along with the same sense of safety and security that I get to go through. So yeah, there's all kinds of it's definitely no such thing as a universal trans experience.
I hadn't thought about the fact that like a transition could place someone in a position where they feel less threatened. I always thought, oh, the difficulties of transitioning and managing those things, but it could put you in a position where you walk into a space and you don't feel as vulnerable as you did before. So that's fascinating. So you just talked about how there's a ton of variability in of experience within the United States, within our culture, based on, you know, other components of your identity, because we're all, you know, human beings are complex. They have all these various identities. Can you talk a little bit about, I think this gets at that this is a construction. This is like, we're making this shit up. Like we're like, how we conceive of human beings is different across time and space. Can you talk a little bit about maybe how, just so that people know that the way we conceive as a culture conceive of these issues is different. Like there are different places in the world today and there are mm-hmm. different times across history where, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, so our understanding of sex and gender and sexuality, all those components of human identity, yes, they are not fixed. They change, they vary by culture, they vary by time. For most countries like the United States, England, Australia, that have that similar colonial history, of you know, going in and enslaving people and killing native people, we have a similar history on this point as well, because when we did that, when our ancestors, European ancestors, did that in all these various places around the world, part of what they brought with them was this very rigid binary sense of sex and gender that then was enforced and basically, I mean, off the top of my head, I can't think of a resource. I know there's a website that maps, that has an interactive map of the world, and you can click on different areas and it will pop up and give history of different diverse genders and different ways of which gender was viewed in all these different ways. In different cultures and different points in history. And there was lots of cultures everywhere that that recognized or celebrated third genders or non-binary genders. You know, obviously they used different language than what we have come up with now in our English language, but you know, widely recognized. Some were even celebrated, some were part of religious ceremonies, some of them, you know, were religious leaders, whatever, like, and then the white European colonials come in and just destroy all of it, right? They do everything they can to erase it, and they use it as an excuse for that erasure, that these people are abnormal, they're savages, they're, you know, they're freaks, whatever. And they use that excuse, yeah, for the colonialization and for the erasure. That's how we ended up, you know, where we are in the U.S. culture. And it's just extended throughout time. It's part of the same, it's very closely linked to white supremacy and white, it's not just about race, it's also about masculinity and gender. The two are heteropatriarchy, that's a phrase Angela Davis uses a lot that I'm a fan of. It's the same thing, cisgenderism, heterosexism, white supremacy, it's all comes from the same root, the same source, same place.
And if you want to, like, I read a great book about the conquest, and it was it's called Body of the Conquistador. And it was talking about how during the conquest, the Spanish government had all these rules and regulations about what people coming to the new world could eat. And the thought was, is that if you're eating these native, too many of these native foods, your humors are going to be screwed up, and you're going to turn into a savage. You're going to descend into this other. So it was about constructing human bodies in this ongoing process of reconstructing the human body in the new world and controlling behavior as a way to maintain control over a geographic space. So it makes sense that when you flash forward to the 21st century, that in the United States, that there's going to be a continued concerted effort to control human beings. And that's going to be what we eat, who we have sex with, how we have babies, how we raise them, how we raise our families are constructed. And because people in power want to, I think they feel compelled to shape and exert that. Mm-hmm. And why else get power if it's not to exercise it? And so I'm sorry, I'm ranting a little, I'm going off a little bit, but this the changes. So if somebody today is listening to this and maybe they're not familiar with these issues, they haven't thought about it, they don't know somebody personally, they, you know, and they see these changes and it's threatening to them, shouldn't they just look at this and say, this is a construct, this is something, like I said, some stuff we've made up, some ways we thought about interpreting it, and times the way we should evolve and change in the way we conceive of them as we learn more about human beings. And I mean, is this what's happening? Are we experiencing a change right now in the way we conceive of these things?
We're getting there. We're getting there. Still got a long ways to go. So there's a couple different things that happen both on an individual level, social level, cultural level, is that as human beings, we tend to get very attached to our belief systems and to what we perceive to be right and wrong or normal or abnormal, and, you know, the whole process of socialization and even how these things get wired into our brain as we develop. It's very difficult for some people to let go of these things, especially if they are somehow benefiting from it, right? Mm-hmm. So this is an unfortunate issue we're having right now with a particular group of feminists who are, not open to recognizing trans men and women as men and women. And they come from a perspective of feminism that is very it's very personal to them and to the to their perspective of protecting women from men, and they are they have a very specific view of feminism that doesn't have room for intersectionalities. You know, even women of color get left behind in some of their arguments, because they are unfortunately attached to the police system and the patriarchal system and what it they view it as protecting them and helping them, when there's plenty of documentation that shows that it is not doing that. You know, especially like with domestic violence and rape and sexual assault, our laws and police have done very little of good or positive in those realms. And yet they are attached to that system as it is. And so they fight very hard against this notion of trans women actually being men who are invading mm-hmm. women's bathrooms and things like that. Right? Like, it's very, and these aren't just activists. These are scholars. These are people with PhDs who make these arguments still today. So we have a long way to go on these things.
I'm a little overly optimistic.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, yeah.
Okay. I appreciate that. I'm rarely accused of being optimistic, but I think in this case, maybe I'm right. So let's talk about that. So like change. So we have this brutal history of oppression, and we have a struggle that's ongoing, and we want to change. You gave me a couple things to read. One of them was about training. Mm-hmm. So like right now I hear with policing is sort of my thing, and use of force. And I, you know, and I am find myself saying train. We could solve a lot of, which I do believe that training can be helpful in many respects for many things, but it's not necessarily the cure all. Can you talk a little bit about the study you gave me about this, maybe the central research question and how they went about answering the research question in the Australia?
So I gave you an article from Toby Miles Johnson in Australia, because there isn't an identical study like that in the US that I'm aware of, because we're behind on this. I mean, that study was published like 4 years ago.
We're behind on a lot of things.
Yeah. He was able to do participant observations. You know, field work where he actually went in, sat in, observed a police training as it was going on, in which officers were being trained on how to interact with the transgender community, right? Basically like trans 101 kind of thing for them. And he observed, basically what is going on in America as well as with these kinds of police trainings. I was actually part of one last year. I got to be a co-instructor for the Houston Police Department as they were doing their mandatory in-service training on transgender issues and hate crimes. They wanted an actual trans person involved, so I did a lot of those trainings along with a sergeant in the department who was my new LGBTQ liaison officer. So the two of us tag teamed the trainings. And it went really well, not at first, but eventually it got figured out where it went pretty smoothly. There's a lot of reticence, there's a lot of pushback, there's a lot of officers who will just, some will openly argue with you, and most will just sit there, arms crossed, you know, stern look on their face, like, I don't care, I'm not going to change. And that's the case. Like, even this sergeant, she was very protective of me, because she knew And we saw, you know, some of the things that happened, questions people would ask, inappropriate questions. We tried to head that off, you know, by giving them but sometimes it would still happen anyway.
Did you find the age of the officers? Did you find that there was difference in the ages amongst the ages?
I used to make that generalization a lot, that we just need to wait for the older generations to, you know, retire and die off. And I think there's some element of validity to that, but it's not universal by any means. It definitely shouldn't be used as an excuse for older people who refuse to learn or change. But yeah, it was a mixed experience. Like I would talk with this officer and she'd be like, you know, half of the people in the room aren't going to change, right? Like this 2.5 hour training is not going to take someone who's transphobic or homophobic and make them a better person. It's not. So we really emphasized like, just, this is what it means for your job. This is what you have to do to be a good officer. This is what you want to do if you want to keep your job in this department, right? Like, we weren't out to change their minds or beliefs because we knew that we couldn't. Mm-hmm. And even if we tried, like, everything, it would just blow up in our faces, right? Like, so we didn't even really try. Like, she started right off with that from the forefront, and realized that it put people at ease. If we laid it out there right in the front that, you know, we're not here to challenge your beliefs, they would calm down. You know, like, there was even one time where a guy was sitting in the front row with his Bible open, and as soon as she gave her little intro, he closed it and just sat there and didn't say anything, didn't do anything for the next 2 hours, right? Like, so you have to be practical, you have to be realistic about these trainings and the limitations of their impact. Yes, you can train them on how to ask for the correct pronouns and how to, you know, don't make assumptions based off the driver's license and, you know, very practical things on how to interact with people. That doesn't mean they're going to become an advocate for LGBTQ people. Like, it's just not going to happen, right? Like, so there's limitations. Like, even, I have to give this example because it just gets me so much.
Please, please.
So the DOJ, a few years ago, I want to say this was like 4 years ago now, they made a video under their community policing office, a training video for law enforcement on how to interact with the transgender community. It's a great video as far as, you know, it gives basic definitions. It has actual trans people involved to explain their identity, their experience, their feelings about law enforcement. And then it gives three really common scenarios: a traffic stop, a reported like assault, and someone calling because they think there's a man in the woman's restroom, right? And it just shows them, this is the appropriate way to respond. This is the way to handle it. There's no need to escalate things that aren't even a violation of the law, right? Very straightforward. It was recorded using the what is the name of the department? The Prince Albert something department that's near in Virginia or, oh man, I hate myself. I'm forgetting the name of this department. But it was recorded using them and their officers and then just a couple years later, that exact department is in the news for anti-trans violence and harassment. So like, that's, I think, a pretty good example of like, you can use this department as like the model for your training video, but it does not mean that these attitudes and beliefs don't continue and that they don't come through in police interactions, right? So...
Yeah, and this idea that you're going to sit people down for 2 hours, and or that they're going to make a video in an afternoon and have some trans folks come in, and that's going to fundamentally change something that's been built over hundreds of years and a culture
involved
over hundreds of years. In the Australian thing, an article, they talk about Australia. They talk about how the researchers were kind of like, not, I don't want to say shocked, but like a little bit surprised at how little exposure to the material officers have had in the past. So they were, it's a training and it's like brand new to them. The officers that you interacted with, was this something that was this like first the first time it had been addressed, or was were you reinforcing prior education?
Oh no, this for most of them this is the very, very first time. And that's where the generational thing definitely comes in. It oftentimes was older officers who were grouchy, grumpy, questioning, arguing. And then occasionally on the breaks, I would have younger officers come up to me and apologize, like on behalf of their colleagues, and be like, you know, I'm sorry, just ignore those guys, oh, yeah. Just old jerks, you know, a lot of us don't feel that way anymore, you know. That's where it's most evident, because there are, yes, a lot of, for the best generalization, millennials and Gen Zers who are now entering law enforcement, who are more exposed, who are more aware, because they have grown up in a different society where there's been more visibility, more acceptance, more education on gender diversity. And so, yeah, it's also going to be much easier to train or to create a different police culture with officers who already have a different mindset.
Right.
What is, I think, pretty much impossible is to change a set in mindset of someone who's been doing this work for a set amount of time, who's very much ingrained into, you know, a specific culture and perception of their job and yeah, all that.
Right. And I know that, like, you're talking about this, I think, so I observed in my experience in policing a real growth of a movement for amongst like gay men and gay women in policing, mm-hmm. where people were like pushing. I had a friend of mine who he posed in uniform in a magazine, a gay magazine. It was like a big controversy. Mm-hmm. Now that would not be. That would be like, oh, he's community, that's community policing. And he rose through the ranks, and there's like a support network within, there was a support network within mm-hmm. the department, especially for gay women. And you saw people who were gay men and women who were entering the profession, there was a support network in place to make it easier for them, like than it had been for the generation before them in policing. But I think that what you touched on about this, like it being, there are people who are, may not be conforming to society's quote unquote norms when it comes to sexuality or gender, but there are some who are able it's much more difficult. So like, mm-hmm. a gay man or a gay woman in policing, I think nowadays it's still, you know, they're going to encounter discrimination, but I think it's gotten a lot better. Whereas for trans folks, I didn't see that movement. Like there's no like group of trans folks that I knew in my department who were there to welcome new people to the profession. Because it seems to me that if we want to really change policing, wouldn't we need to have a push to have trans officers? Have you seen that?
I mean, obviously, we would want to do something to make it open and safe and accessible for trans officers. I think it's been happening very much in the same way that it did with gay and lesbian officers. If you go back like 20, 30 years ago, you know, gay, lesbian and trans officers have always been there. They've been in our departments, but they just haven't been open. They haven't been safe. It hasn't been safe for them to be out, right? You know, throughout the 90s and especially early 2000s, we saw a steady increase because socially, culturally, as a country, right, we were moving in that direction where it was okay and safe for gay and lesbian people to be out. So socially and culturally, we have to get there for trans people as well. There are trans officers. I've met a handful. they are usually the I haven't actually met one that wasn't the first in their department, you know, where they had to on their own figure out how to come out at work and figure out, you know, push for policy changes and all of that, so that people behind them wouldn't have to, you know, struggle.
That's a lot to ask of a person.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It is. Yeah. But I mean, even statistically speaking though, but right, like trans people are like 2% of the population, or no, less than that, 1%. I don't even know. We don't know, right? We have no accurate estimate on these numbers.
I'm sure people have different definitions.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and what I think is what I've found to be universally true. So I've done some research on gender and in policing and specifically LGBTQ officers. And what seems to be almost universal with them is that they really are attached or feel strongly about the concept and notion that they just have to be a good cop. They just have to be a good officer, do their job well, and you know their identity won't matter as much. It won't become an issue. And this especially seems to be the case for lesbian identified officers. They seem to be benefiting pretty greatly from the stereotypes of lesbian women as being masculine. Like, they are rising through the ranks. They are becoming commanders and chiefs. I don't know statistics, but just from what I have observed, they seem to be doing much better than gay male officers, who are still, I mean, I've seen headlines, I've heard stories. I've even had lesbian officers from large departments tell me to my face, yeah, the guys aren't gonna talk to you. They're not out, they're not safe, they're not gonna talk to you. And they were right, we tried, and they wouldn't talk to us. So it's, even on that level, the stereotypes that we have of gay men as being feminine and weak is, and the police culture of masculinity being like, you know, what you have to be, what you have to do in order to be a good officer, you have to present and act in a certain way, is playing to the benefit of lesbian identified officers and to the detriment of gay male officers. But that's just what I've observed. Again, not universal, but it seems to be a dynamic that is still very much at play.
And you talk about, you just mentioned maybe the reason why lesbian officers are able to navigate the space is because it's such a male-dominated profession with preconceived notions about the role of masculinity and effective policing. And they talk about that in the paper you sent me about in Australia, this being a male-dominated profession. Can you just talk about how that works? So how it being male-dominated puts up barriers for transgender people in the profession and in dealing with police officers?
So specifically how the male domination relates to trans people or trans officers?
Both. So I think it's for sure it's different, but this it being a male dominated culture, how that puts up barriers to people interacting with law enforcement in any kind of way. Even like if you want to be a dispatcher, if you want to be an employee, if you want to be an officer, or if you're being stopped for walking down the street, what is that the fact that the policing is, and it is, I mean, geez, it's a male dominated environment. Yeah. The testosterone and the macho-ness, I mean, it's something I found that it was easier for me to navigate the social space, to get assignments, to make friends, to be respected by my colleagues if I acted like a little bit of a meathead, you know, which it was easy for me to do. go ahead. What are your thoughts? I know that's a kind of a tough question, but go ahead.
It's like you're saying, it's the culture of policing, the expectations, not just to hold a position and do the job, but to get along with your coworkers, to be like the locker room talk kind of stuff and the social events outside of work, right? There's been a lot of work on how LGBTQ officers are excluded often from those kinds of things, and how they constantly have to deal with homophobic and transphobic language and comments and jokes being made in their presence. And yeah, so there's, it's again, the masculine part of policing is attached to the whole notion of power and dominance and control. So it comes through in how they interact with anyone who violates those norms about a someone assigned female at birth has to be feminine and has to be a woman, and someone assigned male at birth has to be masculine and has to be a man, right? People who violate those norms are definitely at high risk for coming under the guise and control of law enforcement, who see that violation and for whatever reason perceive it to be a threat to the social order, a threat to maintaining social control.
Is this the in-group, out-group, like where you...
So I think a lot of people have probably heard of the us versus them mentality in policing, and it's not just about police being the good guys and criminals being the bad guys. It's also extends to policing being a white, heterosexual, male profession, occupation, culture, whatever. And even in these police trainings, like this article that I gave you, a good portion of the officers in the room, in the training, identified as gay or lesbian. And yet everyone else in the room just kind of ignored that and acted like they weren't there and continued on with their homophobic and transphobic comments and jokes and speaking of police as assumed to be cisgender heterosexual, and them referring to anyone else who is not cisgender and heterosexual. And it's such a part, like you have to, it's such a part of the culture and the acceptance for an officer that they, even though there was a considerable number of them in that room, none of them felt like they could speak up and correct these comments and derogatory jokes that were being made. Like, that's, it's all part of the same, us versus them mentality.
This reminds me of an experience I had. So I was a new officer and it was a domestic violence call, and I worked in a migrant community. So it was this woman from Mexico, her husband had, slapped her in the face a few times, and she had like a little bit of bruising and some swelling. He'd broken a couple things and then took off. And it was like this was something that you deal with on a day. This was just a regular call. I shouldn't remember it, because it was just one of many that I encountered, but I do. And it was because of the way that I interpreted it. It was like an aha moment for me, where we were in the apartment, and one of the things you would do is take a look around in the apartment to make a note of the living conditions. If there are kids there, you want to, you'd say, well, the kids seemed happy and healthy, the clean clothes, there's food in the cupboards, it was just part of the report. And I was walking around the apartment while my Spanish speaking partner collected her information, and I became very angry about what had happened to her, more so than I found myself typically becoming angry by something like this, and I thought about this later as I went to extra lengths to track the guy down who had beaten her up. Mm-hmm. Where we made a couple steps, couldn't find him. Normally I would have just written the report and sent it to a detective and move on to the next thing. But in this case, I took a couple extra steps and ended up tracking him down. And I think looking back on it, what it was walking around the apartment and seeing her conform to my idea of what a mother should be. So the kids were there was order in the home. So it was neat and tidy. Though the woman presented as a woman I could identify with as a motherly figure, like the way she dressed, the way she carried herself, the way she spoke, all of those things gave me signals that she was part of my tribe. Going into the bedroom, this is going to sound maybe stupid, but I looked in the kids' bedroom and the beds were made and they were like neatly tucked and they had like Disney character bedspreads. And so in my mind, I didn't think about it consciously. Later, I thought about it consciously, but it were all of these signals to me that this woman was conforming to the rules and regulations that and the expectations that we have of her as a woman. And it made it so that I felt a strong sense of obligation to protect her. Whereas if I had gone into that apartment and it was messy and she didn't have the bedspreads and she was having some difficulties, maybe if she looked different or presented her gender in a different way, I still would have treated her with respect and asked the questions and written a thorough report and done my job and arrested the guy. But I really wouldn't have taken those extra steps. So I think it's not always like just like you said, the officer's just doing your job right, like that they would just doing it right, just following. Here's what you need to do as an officer to treat a person from this community fairly. I think it does need to go much deeper to recognizing that this is a human being who is I love and respect like any other human being and is worthy of my protection, regardless of they have a friggin' Disney bedspread on their thing. So I don't know.
No, you touched on a really good point. It gets into this notion of the ideal victim that we have, that some people are readily looked at and accepted as victims who need to be protected and who need to be, justice needs to be served. And typically, what that means is it's a white woman or child, right? That's the readily accepted ideal victim, someone who for whatever reason, we connect to the notion of innocence right off the bat. And when you, so I mean that really comes through in the way that we other people so readily the signals that we look for in us versus them. Yeah, it can go into all kinds of different ways of how we stereotype people. And it's really sad too because I mean in that scenario like the mother who is struggling is probably the one that needs your help more, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
But we walk around with all these things in our head and are not always consciously aware of the impact that it has on our decision making.
Right, and I can't, and now that I think back, I can't imagine how many times there were people who needed help where I'm sure I did, I did what I was supposed to do, but people turn, for police officers, people turn into like just like a work product. It's just something that you work with during, during the day, and they sort of they disappear. But I think that being the ideal victim or drawing on those things. So that said, how do we have these preconceived notions about transgender people within the law enforcement community? There are these stereotypes and ideas that police officers have. How do we go about changing the culture of policing so that police officers view, and I'm going to ask you, and this will be the last question. We're kind of on time, so this will be kind of where we leave it. I'll give you some final thoughts, but how do we shape policy? What would you recommend? And I know that this is, we don't have a lot of data because, like you said, it's just not being studied like it should. But based on what you know, what can we do as a society to implement policy change so that we can begin the process of making policing a more, so that policing works for people who identify as transgender in America? What can we do? What tangible steps can we take? Sorry for the tough question, all yours.
Oh boy. Okay. So, I mean, a lot of it is very similar to just the general reforms that we need in policing, across the board. So, I mean, we can't, even though we know training has limited impact, it doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Education and training is always going to be necessary. It's just that is never going to be sufficient.
Right.
Because to change culture, and police culture is not monolithic. It does vary by agency and whatnot. But general elements of it sure seem to be heavily ingrained. That's going to take more. That's going to take changes in leadership, changes in policy, changes in training and recruitment of the new officer. Like when we talk about training, that's probably where the focus needs to turn to, is rather than having them spend like a third of their police academy on use of force and firearms, we need to shift more towards citizen interaction and crisis intervention and de-escalation of scenarios, right? Which most academies spend an average of 1 day on de-escalation tactics. That's unacceptable, like universally. And that is not, that is, oh man, so much of this, the US just stands out on its own as the exception for how police are trained.
We're number one.
Yeah. Like there's other countries in where police are required to have a college degree. And there's research that shows that educated officers are better officers. They are less likely to use forces. They are more likely to be able to solve problems and use critical thinking skills because guess what? They developed that in college. Like we're going the opposite direction. Police departments right now are concerned with their ability to recruit and maintain their numbers. So they're actually eliminating what little education requirements they had in place. Not okay. But bigger picture, so this is also coming up with police violence with communities of color, is that we are asking police to do too much. Transgender people, like I've mentioned, are disproportionately likely to be unemployed and homeless, which means they are coming into contact with police on the streets and in public places more frequently and more often than they should be or need to be. And people are probably calling the police on them, knowing how the police are going to respond to this, you know, obviously gender diverse or person or whatever. So we need to have other options to call other than the police when we're dealing with those kinds of interpersonal crises, whether it's homelessness, whether it's substance use, whether it's vagrancy, which is what they use to go after people who don't have jobs, right? And are just walking around on the street during the day. All of those kinds of things should not be under the purview of police. We need to have other, and that's where the defunding argument comes in. It's not about like eliminating police. It's just about our values and our priorities with our public budgets. For several decades now, we have been decreasing our investment in social services and in our welfare systems, in our infrastructure. And even though crime has generally been on a decreasing trend for about three decades now, with some ticks recently.
But it's pretty remarkable how...
Yeah. Even though crime has been going down, police budgets have been going the opposite way. So for some reason, police have done a very good job of convincing us that they need more and more and more money. And, you know, the DOD budget comes into this because they give all of their excess military equipment to police. And now we have military departments instead of community policing departments. Like, it's all big picture. And it all comes down and impacts transgender people in very much the same ways that it impacts the Black communities and immigrant communities, right? It's all part of the same problem.
So maybe it's not about changing the culture, well, change the culture of policing. That's something that needs to happen. But maybe it's a matter of not sending the cops to handle a problem, to help homeless people. Maybe if the social problem is we have a homeless person camped out over here, blah, 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 whatever the problem is, maybe sending the police isn't the best way to handle that. Or if somebody has an addiction, sending the police is not, has a mental health crisis, sending armed police is not the best way to handle it. So depolicing, when you say depolicing, and I totally agree with this, it's about a reallocation of resources to agents that are better trained and more well-suited to address the social problem than police. Because if you send a hammer to solve a problem, they're going to hit a nail, right?
I mean, that's
kind of what they do.
Go
ahead.
And also priorities within police agencies, right? Like they don't have to spend their time, walking around the nightclubs and picking up transgender women. They choose to do that. They can make their priority, you know, serious violent crimes instead, right? Like, that's a simple thing, too, that just reprioritize how they are using their existing resources.
So a broad reconsidering how we allocate funds, and then at the sort of micro level within the department, how, once those funds are allocated to the department, reconsidering how those resources are deployed on the street.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you, if you could, I think everyone listening to this would benefit, that interactive map, if you could maybe email that to me.
Yeah, sure.
The training video too, if you could, and then I could put it in the description. That way, if people are listening to this or watching this, they can refer to those things. I've had you on here for like way longer than I planned to, so I appreciate your time. But I wanted to just give you one last chance. So I have police officers who listen to this. I have academics and regular citizens, just people who are interested in policing. So I have a wide variety of people who are going to check this out. What would your sort of final, given where we are right now, 2020 in America, all that's going on, what are your sort of final thoughts on this issue, what you'd like to leave the audience with?
Well, I'm actually feeling fairly optimistic right now that we are in a key historic moment in US society where we can finally start getting some of the large scale reforms that we need. We just need to have the willpower to make these changes happen. We have examples, we have research, we have things that we can look to for how to do it. We don't have to come up with it completely on our own. It's doable.
So you're optimistic.
I am.
Okay. Well, I think that I'm happy leaving it on an optimistic note. And I wanted to thank you for your time. I'm going to put your bio info down below with your academic info. If anyone has any and wants to reach out to you, they can go through your department page and reach out to you. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time, and have a great week.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me.